This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we speak with attorney Charles Aberesk about his work with the Native American community in South Dakota.
He'll talk about conditions on the reservation and comparisons of U.S. colonialism and Israeli colonialism.
We'll listen to our own Michael Ratner's talk at Brooklyn for Peace. It's called From Guantanamo to WikiLeaks, Taking on the State in a Post-9/11 World. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. As our listeners know, Mamiya remains in prison, but he speaks around the world. His latest speech at Goddard College apparently caused some issues.
Well, Michael, many of our listeners may be aware of what we call the Mamiya exception, and that's the fact that for several decades, courts have kind of tailored the laws to not apply constitutional rights to Mamiya. But now we have a new bill that came out of a House committee in Pennsylvania a day after Mamiya addressed graduates in a pre-recorded speech of Goddard College, where he himself attended. The bill is believed to be the first of its kind, and it would let crime victims or relatives of crime victims seek injunctive relief if these individuals, so-called criminals that harmed them, seek publicity from the crime in any way. So it's kind of an extension of the existing law.
What we call the Son of Sam law in New York, I think, which is that convicted criminal cannot profit by writing a book about their crime. The proceeds have to go to the victims, right? It's something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. Right. So this, I want to just quote from one representative, Mike Verab from Montgomery, a Republican, called it unconscionable that Abu Jamal could get national exposure for what he calls a taxpayer-funded rant. He said that the words of the victims should be louder than the criminals who sit behind concrete and steel. So he actually drafted the bill when he learned that Mamiya had been invited to speak to graduates at Goddard. And the full House could vote on this bill any day now. What the memo that this person, Vera, wrote to fellow lawmakers said it would allow crime victims or prosecutors acting on their behalf to bring a civil action to halt conduct by an offender if it causes the victim or the victim's family severe mental anguish. And, of course, Senator John Rafferty said he actually urged the Goddard graduates to speak with Daniel Faulkner's widow, Maureen, or take a ride with a Philadelphia police officer. So luckily the ACLU has responded saying that this bill could restrict the free speech rights of all felons, even those who have paid their dues to society. So we'll stay tuned on this one.
You know, you have to love these people in Pennsylvania. I mean, that's where Mamiya is doing his life sentence, and they just won't let go of him.
They can't let it go.
You know, we've always talked on this program of the Palestine exception to free speech in the First Amendment. So now we have the Palestine and the Mamiya exception
right.
to free speech. But it's really an outrage. I mean,
right.
It's really shocking. And it's what's interesting, it's just about if someone feels bad because of what you're saying.
Exactly. Well, it's sort of like victim impact statements, where if you're being accused of a crime, say murder or homicide, and they allow, certain courts allow the family to give victim impact statements, which I've always felt were overly prejudicial and shouldn't be allowed in, but we seem to have a trend that way. Bring the emotions into the courtroom. Michael, at long last, we have some litigation concerning forced feeding at Guantanamo Bay Prison.
You know, I've never liked the forced feeding regime. It's horrible. A lot of countries prohibit forced feeding of anyone who's on a hunger strike, saying it's up to the individual to decide how they're going to live or not live. That law came out of the Irish hunger strikes, and if people may recall or not, but know about Bobby Sands and others who died because they refused to be force-fed, and they actually went to their deaths. In this case, the United States is force-feeding many Guantanamo detainees. Over the years, they've done it to break the hunger strikes because they realize hunger strikes are serious, and a dead Guantanamo person might actually force this country to move and to close the place. People should know the statistics. There's still 147 people at Guantanamo. 79 of those people have been cleared for release, which means the United States has found them not guilty of anything and that they can be released. But of course, they remain there sometimes 12 years after. Some of those are on a hunger strike.
Let me ask, Michael, do they intubate these individuals to force feed, or do they give them an IV? How is it done?
Yes, the force feeding is done by what you call intubation, which is sticking a tube down through their nose and into their stomachs. And they leave that tube there sometimes for weeks. And of course, that's very uncomfortable. It can cause infections.
Right.
And of course, from their point of view, it's just easier. Why should we force this tube down each time? The tube is one part of it. The first part is what they call cell extraction, so that the person who actually has a litigation pending in front of a federal judge in Washington is a man named Abu Wael Diab, who has been in Guantanamo since 2002. He was cleared for release, listen to this, in 2009. He's been forcibly extracted from his cell 1,300 times.
No.
Has gone through force feedings for many, many years, and has gotten the litigation going around this issue of whether it's legal to do, whether it constitutes torture in which it's done, whether he should have the right to refuse force feeding. The first thing that happened was interesting in the case, and it's going on as we speak, and we may have a decision, I hope, in the next couple of weeks, is last week, the judge in the case, Judge Gladys Kessler in Washington, ordered that the Guantanamo Bay force-feeding videos be released. There's 28 of them. The government opposed it on national security grounds, whatever that means. Kessler, the judge, just shot it down. What she said, that the arguments that they shouldn't be shown publicly or released were, quote, unacceptably vague, speculative, lack specificity, or just plain implausible. And that the argument that the detainees would somehow learn to develop, quote, countermeasures to defeat force feeding strains credulity, the judge said. So it was a very important ruling by her. But of course, have we seen a videotape yet? No. Because DOJ so far hasn't said they'll comply with the ruling, and they may well appeal to a upper court.
Dragging this on for another year or more, for sure.
The rest of it went on as a trial before the judge. And the trial testimony was remarkable. They examined experts on medical ethics, etc. One of the medical ethicists said, the way they're getting the tube down is they're bathing it in olive oil, so it goes down more smoothly. And what that doctor said was, that's outrageous. You have to use a water-soluble liquid, or else the oil can creep and get into your lungs, and you can get pneumonia from it, and you can never really find it. So interestingly, right after he put in his affidavit and then his testimony, they went to a water-soluble feeding. But this has been going on for years, 10 years
this
now
is
at
appalling.
Least, this forced feeding.
With rogue techniques. Michael, who's representing the inmates?
I think it's Reprieve, which is an organization out of London and has an office in Washington, and a lawyer named Eric Lewis, who's quite good in this case. And the relief they're asking for is, one, you shouldn't have to get a force feeding unless you volunteer to get fed.
Right.
Secondly, a ban on guards forcing detainees out of their cells. And third, if you're going to be force fed, to not do it in a manner that essentially amounts to torture. So the important thing about this case is, first, to hopefully try and relieve some of the inmates or the detainees from being force-fed and from being force-fed in such a painful way. And I should say, with regard to that, it's not only this tube and this whatever substance they put down the tube, Ensure or something like that.
Right.
People are also put into a 5-point restraint chair.
So While that's happening.
Your arms are restrained, your legs are restrained, and your head is restrained.
God.
That's five points.
Can you imagine that?
Four limbs in your head. And that's how they force the tube down. And so you can't force it out. This whole system is torture. Let's be clear. This is torture.
It's torture. But the other point I think you were going to make is, it will also hopefully bring this to the attention of the public, raise some more awareness about really what's going on at Guantanamo.
Right. That's correct. We're sort of, I would have to say, and you'll hear in my talk that maybe on this show, that we're at a dead end on Guantanamo, that we have those 147 people
and
there.
And they've been forgotten by the American public.
And Obama, who promised to close Guantanamo in a year, sits there twiddling his thumbs. So we're talking about a situation that's out of sight, out of mind, in which people are being tortured. So let's hope Gladys Kessler, by her ruling, but even by this court hearing, has at least begun to bring into the forefront a bit this legally inhuman treatment of the Guantanamo detainees.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we talk with attorney Charles Aberesk about his work with the Native American community in South Dakota. Charles is a trial attorney, author, and filmmaker. His documentary, A Tattoo on My Heart, The Warriors of Wounded Knee, 1973, is a gripping documentation of those American Indian men and women involved in the siege. Charles is the Chief Justice of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe Supreme Court, and he's also a member of the South Dakota Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He's the son of James George Aberesk, former Democratic U.S. Representative and U.S. Senator, who was generally viewed as critical of U.S. foreign policy in Israel and Palestine. Welcome, Charlie, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, we understand you're Chief Justice of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe Supreme Court. Tell us a bit about that tribe.
Well, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe is the second largest tribe in South Dakota. There are nine tribal governments total in the state. It's where I grew up. But I spent much of my adult life over on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which has been for a number of years the poorest county in the United States. And I work in both places.
And how did you get interested in the law?
Well, it grew out of my community organization work in Pine Ridge back in the 70s. And I became a tribally licensed lawyer first because there was a lot of, at the time, a heavy FBI presence on the Pine Ridge Reservation. I sort of served the purpose of assisting individuals with advising them of their constitutional rights and so on. And I became interested in the law and eventually went back later in life to law school, long after I'd worked for a number of Indian organizations, including a Native American NGO that worked at the UN in Category 2 status. So I worked there for a number of years on human rights issues for Indians from the Americas.
Charlie, I want to go back a little. Where is the Pine Ridge Reservation? I'm sure a lot of our listeners, they've heard of it. They know about Wounded Knee a little bit. But where is it, and what is the tribal makeup of Pine Ridge?
The Pine Ridge Reservation is the second largest reservation in the United States. It's located in southwestern South Dakota. It's a huge landmass. It takes about an hour and a half to drive diagonally across the reservation. There's very little economy there. You know, the geography is sort of poor. It lends itself to some cattle grazing, but not much in terms of raising crops and so on.
Now, you said you were out there in the 70s at Pine Ridge, and I know that's the years that Wounded Knee happened. Were you around when Wounded Knee happened? And then maybe we can talk about your documentary a little bit, but were you around during that period?
No, I came out. I came back. I had gone out and was living in Virginia for a short while and returned at the end of 1973 and went down to help with the election in 74, which was that year was in January, against Dick Wilson, the former tribal chairman who many had felt had been repressive, particularly toward traditional people on the reservation. And he was aligned with the U.S. government and the FBI and so on. So that's sort of how I got reintroduced to the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Now, I know you made a movie called A Tattoo on My Heart, The Warriors of Wounded Knee, 1973. So I guess the time to talk about the movie, but also really talk about what was Wounded Knee in 1973.
Well, Wounded Knee was the site, of course, of the 1890 massacre in which almost 300 American Indians from several different tribes were killed by the U.S. Army. They were surrounded and essentially murdered on that spot. So in 1973, as there had been a lot of racial discrimination and some racially motivated killings of Indian people, the American Indian Movement returned and joined forces with the traditional people who had long been neglected on the reservation. And as a result of that, they decided to engage in a protest, and they chose the site of the massacre at Wounded Knee to stage that protest. They set up a sort of a line there, and the government and the FBI and the U.S. Marshals, along with Dick Wilson's followers who were armed and were called the Goon Squad, formed the other side of that line, and the siege lasted 71 days, and finally dismantled, and a number of people were prosecuted and so on as a result of that.
I want to go a little bit deeper with you on Wounded Knee. I know there were some people killed there. I know there's, maybe that's not the incident that put Leonard Peltier in jail, but
no,
what
that happened later.
Later, but what happened out of Wounded Knee itself?
Wounded Knee, there were two Indian people killed and one marshal was wounded. The two killed, the first one was Frank Clearwater. He was a medic who had just arrived within a few days, and he was shot in the head as he was in the basement of the church there by a federal round. And then Buddy Lamont, who was actually had been serving in the U.S. Army in Vietnam and had come back and decided to go AWOL and fight for his people instead. And Buddy was killed at about 1,000 yards with a fairly large round. I think they said it was a 300 or something like that, shot right in the chest. And, I think that sort of was the beginning of the end of the protest, because that had been such a stark and overt killing of an Indian person. And I think you started to see shortly after that, at least that's what our film shows, that they began to start to negotiate at that point. And, I guess that sort of worked.
Charlie, tell us about your film, A Tattoo on My Heart, and what motivated you to make it, and what did you intend to do with it?
The film, I started to see a lot of people who were involved in Wounded Knee, many of whom I'd known over the years, were starting to pass away, and I thought this truly needed to be, their stories needed to be documented, and I set to work and had a friend of mine agree to co-produce it and co-direct it with me, Brett Lawler. And we set up a stage on the 30th anniversary of Wounded Knee, or a recording studio right at the Wounded Knee School, and just took people's stories, and I did the interviews, and they're very powerful. There were some stories that really didn't fit with the arc of the film, but which were incredible stories, and that were powerful. And I'm glad I documented that then, because I think of the people who are in the documentary, I think it's 7 or 8 have now passed away. We're happy that we were able to sort of freeze that moment in time and get those stories down.
When we talked about Wounded Knee, and I mentioned Leonard Peltier, was his conviction related in any way to 1973, or a separate issue?
I think that was a separate issue. That happened later. I didn't know Mr. Peltier, but he and some followers had camped out in a small community at the southwestern end of the reservation called Oglala. They were there to sort of lend support, I think, to the traditional people. This shooting incident arose, I guess, out of some contact between them and two FBI agents, and I think that's how that arose. As a result, the reservation, I remember the time I was around then, was flooded with 350 FBI agents and, helicopters, military vehicles, basically full combat gear, and we saw them around the reservation making raids and so on for, I think that went on for 4 or 5 months after the shooting incident. Quite a heavy presence. It was like a war zone.
Charlie, can you tell us about one or two other cases that you've worked on within the Native American community that have been important to you?
Yeah, I guess I continue to be a strong advocate for tribal sovereignty, self-determination, and the rights of individual Indians, especially in the, within the dynamic of racial discrimination, which at times in South Dakota has been as bad as the South is toward African Americans. And there are some improvements in the last 10 years or so, but you still see incidents of racial discrimination. And I've done a lot of cases. I helped affirm and preserve the boundaries of the Yankton Sioux Reservation that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court twice, and I was the lead counsel on that. And when it finally concluded, and we were able to win that one, but one of my favorite cases is a Native American man from Rosebud who was out shopping with his family, and while his family was in the grocery store, he's a Sundancer, doesn't drink. When he went over to the liquor store, because his mother was from Puerto Rico, his father was Native American, and she had passed away, and he used to buy a bottle of rum once a year and pour one drink out on her grave once a month to remember her. He went in to order that, and he had an army jacket on, and the lady refused to sell him the rum, and she said, "You're drunk." And he says, "No, I'm not. I don't drink." And then he says, "Well, can I at least buy these other items?" She says, "No, I'm not selling you anything." He says, "Well, can I speak to the manager?" And she started yelling for security, and three guys came over. They roughed him up inside the store, took him outside, and from a standing position, slammed him face down onto the pavement. He then called the police, and police came and arrested him and took him to jail. And in that process, one of the store employees had him while he was face down, put their knee in his back, and wrenched him up backwards and ruptured his disc in his low back. The verdicts aren't huge, but we went to trial on that with an all-white jury. We were able to prevail and get a $212,000 verdict. And that made a lot of Indian people in the area feel good because, it sort of reflected the treatment that they often receive in the commercial sector around here. That's one of the ones that feels the best, I guess.
Let me ask you, you're a Supreme Court judge for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, and you're also a practicing lawyer at the same time?
Yes, I stay, real involved. I was a former Supreme Court justice on the Pine Ridge Reservation for their Supreme Court, and I retired from that position. But you can do that sort of part-time, and I continue to be a trial lawyer and represent many tribal schools, tribal organizations, and Indian tribes. So I try to stay involved and active.
I think our listeners are probably not aware that there's another system of justice on Indian reservations, and that federal courts have only certain kinds of jurisdiction, and you as a Supreme Court judge on Indian courts have a different kind. Can you just talk about what that's about? I mean, is there some sovereignty of the Indian reservations or what?
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. And many people don't realize that except for limited jurisdiction that the federal government has on criminal matters, the civil jurisdiction for incidents which occur within the reservation lie with the tribal court, as do criminal misdemeanors, both for Indians and non-member Indians, meaning Indians from other tribes that happen to be living on the reservation. They used to have criminal jurisdiction over whites until 1978, when Justice Rehnquist, in a case called Oliphant, reversed that and would not allow them to have criminal jurisdiction over whites anymore. But, these are functioning courts. The Rosebud Lower Court is all the judges are law trained. It's actually quite a wonderful court to try cases in. So, you know, these courts are very modern, but they also try to reflect traditional notions of justice, too, and many courts have a traditional mediation diversion program so they can refer people to elders and let them work out conflicts and so on, which is a good thing because in the Native American view, you can't really have winners and losers. You have to restore the harmony or the balance within the tribe. And so it's kind of a nice sideline, I guess, to that.
Charlie, we wanted to talk briefly about your father, James George Arbaresque, who is a former Democratic U.S. representative and U.S. senator, who was critical of U.S. foreign policy in Israel and Palestine. Can you speak briefly about how that level of colonialism relates to what you see in Native American communities in South Dakota, for example?
Yeah, of course, I know that's a sensitive issue, but the American government adopted the British style of colonialism, as did the Israelis when they began to colonize parts of Palestine. They adopted the British system as well, so you kind of see it hit on all four squares. You know, it kind of goes in four steps: the disruption of traditional agriculture and food gathering, which in out here was done in two ways: one, by killing off the buffalo, and secondly, by constraining them from moving around in a wide arc and hunting and gathering throughout the year in different parts of the country. By putting them on the reservation, they stopped that. The second thing was to transfer commonly owned land into private ownership, to turn land into a commodity that could be bought and sold. And they did that through what was called the Dawes Act, or the Allotment Act, in the late 1800s. That's actually an act that President Theodore Roosevelt, in one of his addresses in early 1900s, called it a mighty pulverizing machine with which to break up the tribal mass. And so that was a deliberate act to sort of isolate and reduce the land areas of American Indians. The third step was to develop a native ruling elite. And in this case, they first developed paper chiefs, and then in the 1930s, developed modern tribal government, which was loosely sort of designed after the American system, except that the Department of Interior sent out constitutions without a separation of powers. And so that sort of remains in effect in most reservations today, the lack of separation of powers, but that was a government design. And then the last one was to develop an educated elite. And of course, like any colonizer anywhere, that's the step that always backfires, because when people get sent off to the mother country or to get educated, they become most acutely aware of the oppression of their people. And that happened with Indians in the relocation era in the 1950s. Indians were sent to the cities to sort of learn how to be good factory workers and so on, and learn trades and skills. And it was a one-way ticket. You didn't get a ticket back home. And so many people ended up there and raised their children in places like San Francisco, L.A., Chicago, Minneapolis. And when the era of activism among Indians happened in the early 1970s, that's where they came from, as the children of those relocated people from that program became the American Indian Movement. It was born in those cities where there was relocation. And, of course, they were the ones who came back home and joined forces with the traditional people and sort of stood up against racism and in favor of tribal sovereignty and tribal self-determination. So, you know, you see many parallels between that and what's happening with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
Charlie, I understand that you're working on not one but two films. Can you tell us what they're about?
Well, I've got actually three in the works. I've got one that's all shot on Floyd Red Crow Westerman, who was a famous Indian singer and actor, who was originally from Sisseton, South Dakota. And that's shot, and that's just in post-production. Then I've got another one called Red State Blues, which is about how Democrats are able to win in conservative states like South Dakota. And, you know, at one time we had my father and George McGovern in the U.S. Senate and a Democrat in the House all at the same time in a state that's a majority Republican, and just how that's done. And I thought that would be informative. And Peter Coyote, the actor, has agreed to do the narration and voice work on that film. So that's still in production.
You spent a lot of time, obviously, in South Dakota on at least two reservations. Have you seen any evolution in terms of better treatment, better economic situation? I mean, we always read, particularly the one I read most about, I guess, would be Pine Ridge. And, you know, the dislocations on there, the poverty, et cetera. What's it like now? Has there been changes?
Yeah, the one thing I want to clear up right away is that there's a sort of a general perception in the United States that all tribes have really good Indian gaming, and therefore the government doesn't have to fulfill its obligations. And that's far from true. There's probably, other than California, which has a huge population base, there's probably only two other areas where gaming is really successful, and that's in the Minneapolis area, what's called Shakopee, and in Connecticut. And other than that, tribes have a very low base. Even if they have a casino, they really aren't making it. That's true of Pine Ridge and other reservations. It's mostly utilized by tribal members. And so, you know, you still see huge unemployment, huge economic problems, and all the socioeconomic problems that flow from that. I was on the Pine Ridge Reservation when Reagan came into office, and unemployment was at 35%. When he left office and after he'd killed off a number of federal programs, unemployment was at 85%. So we saw a marked and a very clear change in the situation of these people who were really pushed to the fringes of American society as a result of Reagan-era programs, or lack thereof. And they've never really recovered from that. I would say that most reservations in the United States, other than those very few that have successful gaming, still need the kind of commitment, you know, like a Marshall Plan or some kind of a reconstruction, like we saw in Europe after World War II with Germany and Japan. We never did that for Indians, and I think we still owe them that because we, after all, occupied and took most of their lands. And I think that the government and the American people still owe that to Indian people to come in and sort of rebuild and make things right. And I would, not to give you too long of an answer, but I would just quickly point you to the work of Dr. William Julius Wilson, who, when he was in Chicago, did a study there and showed that the problems in the black community did not come from, as Senator Moynihan suggested, from some sort of disintegration in the black families, but were the result of corporations leaving the inner cities and fleeing to third world countries where they could make more profits. They had, you know, wealth has no loyalty. And as a result, when you took that, and Dr. Wilson says, in combination with a cordon of employment and housing discrimination around inner city neighborhoods, you know, you saw this implosion. There was nothing to do except develop illicit economies in reaction to that pullout of capital stimulus. And Dr. Wilson makes the point, and I think it's applicable to Indian reservations, that you cannot fix things through self-help because you're just socializing poverty. You have to put the rod of capital stimulus back into Indian reservations just as you do in inner cities. And I still think that's an important point that we need to make to American government and American people.
That's a sobering analysis. Charlie, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you specifically about community members' relationship with law enforcement, because I understand you were a co-founder of the Community Relations Council that formed a few years ago between the city, the mayor, and the law enforcement and leaders in the American Indian community. How are relationships now?
Well, I think they've improved a little, but we formed that in response to several police shootings of Native Americans and killings, actually. And I think the law enforcement knew they were in trouble, too, and so they reached out. We used my law office as a meeting point and brought in leaders from the Native community and all the law enforcement in the area. And I have to give the old chief of police and the old sheriff a lot of credit. They really worked, and the mayor, because they really worked hard with us to come up with some solutions to handling citizen complaints about treatment of Native Americans by the by law enforcement, because they're about 10% of our the city that I live in. But then we had a new police chief after that who didn't have the same commitment. He is now retired, and the new chief of police, I think, has a greater commitment to this. So hopefully we're going to see a renewed interest. But like oftentimes, the power structure is not interested in doing anything until they're in crisis. And there's been another situation where it reaches a boiling point, and oftentimes their minds get clear at that point. And I hope it doesn't come to that. But I do think minority communities all over, as we saw in Ferguson, are really near the boiling point because of conditions and the reaction that we often see from law enforcement against, you know, people who are living in minority communities.
It's been truly a pleasure to talk to you about your many endeavors and your important contributions to human rights. We hope to have you on again to discuss some future victories and your films.
Yes, Charlie, it's Michael Ratner. It's really refreshing. I mean, to hear your view about English colonialism, U.S. colonialism, and Israeli, as well as the situation in the reservations and your lifelong work. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you to both of you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Our own Michael Ratner delivered a talk last week titled From Guantanamo to WikiLeaks, Taking on the State in a Post-9/11 World. Michael was honored with a Pathmaker to Peace Award by the Brooklyn for Peace Organization for his consistent work in litigation against government spying and on behalf of activists being surveilled, including the targeting of Muslims after 9/11. We go now to hear that
speech.
Let me
say just a few words, more words about Michael before I turn turn this over to him. Michael has been instrumental in litigating against government spying in its myriad forms. Hello, NSA. Hope you're having a good time. As you listen to this and watch us, he has been particularly active in responding to the government's targeting of Muslim activists, something that Brooklyn for Peace began doing immediately following 9/11 and the assaults and roundup of anybody who might have been Muslim or Sikh or South Asian or whatever was the determining factor for why people got rounded up. I would say in conclusion that Michael and CCR have been very active on the issues of Palestinian rights. They've represented the Gaza Flotilla, which attempted to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. He's represented the family of Rachel Corrie. He's worked to protect those who advocate on behalf of Palestinians in this country, something that unfortunately, given the pro-Israeli clampdown that we see continuing at the University of Illinois and other places, is absolutely necessary. He is a co-founder of the Palestinian Solidarity Legal Support Organization, which defends the rights of Palestinians across the U.S. Again, this is an area in which Brooklyn for Peace was and continues to be very active. Michael is a worthy recipient. We are honored to have him. I give you Michael Ratner.
Thank you, David. David did work on cases with us, actually, when we were at the center. He worked on, now he reminded me, a case called Falardica v. Pena, which was the first case in the United States where we could hold a torturer who had tortured someone in Paraguay, guilty of torture when he came into the United States. It began a long line of cases of holding dictators overseas who would visit the United States for human rights violations. A very, very important line of cases. David was one of the lawyers, Peter Weiss, Rhonda Copeland, and a couple of others. A historic CCR case in 1981. When I thought about what I was going to say, I was given some advice. Oh, Michael, make it a somewhat legal talk. You know, you're a lawyer. And I said, well, law isn't doing so well these days. I'll try. We'll get to that. But it's not like we're doing really well on the core issues of drones, wars, Guantanamo. We'll get there. Before that, I went and looked at the Brooklyn Peace website, and I was pleased to see two things immediately which are dear to my heart. One, David mentioned, which is the position on ending the Gaza war and ending the occupation. And when I walked in here, someone said, Michael, you should say something more about that because it's not always the easiest issue for people, just as it wasn't the easiest issue for me, who was raised in a very, very Zionist household. I went to Israel when I was a child. I had actually, this is unusual, probably no one in the room had this, I had a hand-painted map of Israel on my ceiling, and I was a Zionist. And it took a long evolution in my own life to get to the position where I was both politically as well as emotionally someone who would support Palestinian rights and ending the occupation. I won't give you all that history. That's not what I'm here for. I can only tell you that one of the key events took place very late in my life. One of the key events was when my children, who are now in their mid-20s, said, well, we're interested in going to Gaza. And so I said, well, go to Gaza on a Code Pink trip. And, of course, we never got into Gaza. And so we flew to Tel Aviv, took a car into the West Bank. And I took my kids, all of us, to Hebron. And once they went through Hebron, they had no issue any longer about how they were going to talk about Palestine and Israel and rights and checkpoints, et cetera. I can only say that emotionally it was a longer distance for me than politically. Politically, I understood it pretty quickly, coming out of the tradition and background I have since the 1960s. Emotionally, it took longer. So that was one thing that on your website, the Brooklyn Peace website, that I liked. The second thing I saw that a position that, again, has not been the easiest, as everybody says, well, what are we going to do with ISIS? We have to bomb, we have to bomb, we have to bomb. And Brooklyn Peace takes a position that it has to be settled through diplomacy and not bombing. Again, a position that I take. And I, again, don't do it out of just naivety. I do it out of some knowledge, and I don't know if many of you have either watched the interviews with Patrick Coburn on Democracy Now! Or read his book, The Rise of the Jihadists, which talks about what happened that brought ISIS to the fore. Of course, we all know, number one, the Iraq War was what devastated that area. We can talk a little bit more about that or get questions. But what Patrick also says is after 9/11, the U.S. went after the wrong people. It should have gone after Saudi Arabia, which was funding all of this, and Pakistan and its security services as well. Gave them a pass, and now, for a combination of factors, we're where we are. Patrick Coburn strongly suggests there has to be some kind of, not a peace treaty, but a truce between Assad, who, of course, the U.S. Had at the overthrow for a long time, but Assad and whatever moderate forces we can find in Syria, as the only way in which we're actually going to get out of there without a 10 or 20-year war. So again, as I look at your website, I was pleased to see those two positions. Another thing that I noticed was that the organization was founded in 1984, right after the invasion of Grenada by the United States. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to Grenada, how many of you knew the revolution. I knew that revolution. I was friendly would be too strong of word, but certainly acquainted with Maurice Bishop. And I brought a case right during that invasion. It was called Conyers v. Reagan, and it was against the illegality of that invasion because it did not have congressional consent. And Congressman Conyers was one of my plaintiffs. He's saying, you bypassed the Congress, you didn't give us the authority to vote on this war, Like the other cases which I'll mention, we lost that case. We lost it at least on the grounds that the war only took 4 days and it was over, so that it was, quote, moot. But it again showed me trying to litigate in any way to hold this government accountable for restrictions, particularly on war, whether it's the congressional requirement that you have Congress approve a war, or the UN requirement that you can't go to war except in self-defense, or under Section 7 of the UN Charter. Those, when the U.S. wants to make war because it perceives that war is the way it keeps its hegemony or interest, it makes war. All the laws in the world are not going to stop it. I go back, as I think, of course, of King's speech in 67, which is still my favorite single speech, the Riverside speech, when he went beyond Vietnam and started talking about Vietnam and not just civil rights at home. And he said three things which you all know, and I like to evaluate sometimes where we are on those three things: the triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. So it's only been 33 plus 14, 47 years since that speech. And if we look at racism, and we just put in Ferguson and the new Jim Crow, we don't have a lot of good to say in advancement on that issue. If we look at extreme materialism, just think about Occupy Wall Street and the 1%. And if we look at militarism, we probably are fighting more wars than I remember in my history of fighting wars for the last 40 years. That's the situation we're living in. So I don't have to tell you all, we have plenty, plenty of work to do. They insisted my talk have a title. And they went back and said, title this, title that, let's appeal to people. So we titled it From Guantanamo to WikiLeaks, Taking on the State in a Post-9/11 World. Now, one thing I should say, we have not been very successful in taking on the state in the post-9/11 world. But let's talk a little bit about that title. One is Guantanamo. Guantanamo was really CCR's and my earliest case post-9/11. Before that, just before that, we had roundups of Muslims in the city, checkerboarded around to different prisons. We had a couple of Arabic speakers in the office so we could represent them, but we could never actually find where they were. We ultimately brought a case called Turkmen, in which we are still arguing about parts of it, but which we prevailed, in which Muslims were just picked up arbitrarily. There were certain ages in certain countries, but without any guilt of anything at all. The Guantanamo cases were the first real set of cases. And at the time we took them, we didn't know people would go to Guantanamo, but we knew that the president had issued an order saying he could pick up any person anywhere in the world and take them to an offshore prison, and they would have no trial and no right to test their detention. You probably all know that story. At that time, it was late 2001. The first people went to Guantanamo in January 2002. The center started by representing some of the first people at Guantanamo. We could get no other human rights organization in the country to do it. They were afraid of losing their funding. They were afraid the anger in the country was too great, and no one else would join us. A couple of other lawyers, death penalty lawyers, did join us on that. I guess, you know, death penalty lawyers are used to that kind of anger in a community. So we began with Guantanamo, and despite the efforts of all of the lawyers we eventually put together, some 600 lawyers, as David said, we haven't yet closed Guantanamo. And in my view, I'm talking about Guantanamo in the title because it's emblematic, really. It's emblematic of the barbarism that this country has sunk into. What I call at Guantanamo forever detention, drones, which are assassinations, torture, which we did on a rampant scale, war, which we're doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we'll count them, war crimes, massive surveillance. We're in a very, I don't want to be Pollyannish here, we're in a very dark time. So that's that part of the title. The other part is WikiLeaks. And that gives me more hope, not necessarily in a grassroots level, which is where I think change comes from, but in the sense that it's really opened up this government. And when I speak about WikiLeaks, I'm not just talking about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I'm talking about Chelsea Manning, who gave out hundreds of thousands of pages of the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, the collateral murder video, the 150,000 pages of Cablegate. I'm talking about Chelsea Manning. I'm talking about Jeremy Hammond, who hacked into a private security company. And I'm talking about Edward Snowden, who is in Moscow. Those are people who, in the face of this, what I would call barbarism, actually made choices, choices that could literally, in some cases, did put them into jail and still may put them into jails for a long time. So those are the kind of people and the heroes that we need to take on the state, the Chelsea Mannings, the Ed Snowdens, and the like. And when I thought about it, I had a discussion recently, I was just saying to David, I recently met with a group which probably most of you don't know. It's called the MST. It's the Movement for the Landless Peasants in Brazil. And it's huge. It's 2.5 million landless peasants who over the years have fought to get their land back and have an incredibly organized system. They have activist schools. They're probably one of the major social, progressive social forces in the world right now. Very active in Brazil. And I spent a lot of time talking to them. How do you work? How do your schools work? How are the wage differentials work? You know, there's 400 lawyers in the group, et cetera. How does all of this work? After we had that long discussion, they started asking me all about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, and the rest. And they spent an hour with me knowing where are they, what are they doing, why are they doing this. And it seemed peculiar and odd to me. I said, they're organizing this huge landless peasants movement, and why do they care about these cases that have exposed both wide government surveillance as well as criminality by the U.S. government? A lot of people have supported WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning, the whole exposure on the basis of we shouldn't be surveilled, we should have privacy, government criminality should be exposed, and this is all a good thing. What MST said to me, one of the leaders of MST said to me, without missing a beat, he said, the reason we support Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, WikiLeaks, is because what they did is a blow against imperialism. To hear that from the global South saying what is going on for them is that this is a way of beginning to tear apart the fabric of hegemony of the United States. And if I have to admit to myself why I have taken so much effort and the center so much effort around defending WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, and the others, is because we don't see it as just a question of beating back surveillance. Of course you have to do that, or of just exposing criminality. But we see it as some way of beginning to throw some kind of a wrench into this hegemonic system that, in my view, is still what King said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. So that explains probably better than anything my own involvement. We can talk a little bit about the third part of the talk. It says, taking on the state in a post-9/11 world. As I said, at first I didn't want to make that talk because it's not exactly a talk of my great or the center's great successes. You know, in the past we won before 9/11. We always had trouble, obviously, winning on national security issues. We won on issues with great hard fights, as you know, even post 9/11, on issues of race, particularly in this city, a stop and frisk, as well as the fire department discrimination case. Those took 14 years. They didn't finally get settled until we had a new mayor. The other mayor fought us tooth and nail on what should be bread and butter non-discrimination cases, complete bread and butter. But on the other bigger cases taking on national security, we have not had a lot of success. What we looked at 9/11, we looked at, tried to use law as a means of enforcing restraints on force. That's what I mentioned to you with wars, both the Constitution and the UN Charter, as a means of guaranteeing the integrity of human beings so they couldn't get tortured, they couldn't get indefinitely detained, and as a means of holding the government officials accountable. And I have to say, in those respects, the law has been a colossal failure, and not just a failure, but post 9/11 has really eviscerated the lip service that have been paid to legal restraints in this country for many years. The limits on the use of force to settle disputes, in other words, war, rendition, torture, and on, they really don't exist anymore. In a way, it's not a nice story to tell, but I try and think, what can I learn out of this story? What can we all learn? First lesson, and I'll give a couple examples as I go on. First lesson is how relatively easily the United States can cast aside legal constraints when power in this country thinks that war and casting aside those constraints is necessary to continue in power. The bombing of Syria is the latest example. No UN authority, no congressional authority. Second, something we all learn in high school. Sounds great. Checks and balances. Oh my. We're going to have Congress check the executive, we'll have the executive check Congress, we'll have the court check them both, and we'll keep checking each other back and forth. Well, what you realize as you go on in this work, and post 9/11 in particular, is that those three branches of our government all grow from the same tree of U.S. power. And there's a time when that checking doesn't work at all. There's little play in it sometimes, but essentially on national security issues, whether it's war or Guantanamo or torture, those three branches worked hand in hand to ensure that those crimes would occur and that there would be no accountability for them. That's the second lesson. Third, that these laws and these restraints are for others and not for the United States. The U.S. condemns what it calls aggression in other countries, but the U.S. is never the aggressor. It condemns Russia as an aggressor in the Ukraine, but its invasion of Iraq in 2003 is somehow not an aggression. It refers Gaddafi to the International Criminal Court, an international criminal court that the U.S. has refused to join. There are, of course, many, many such examples.
That was our own Michael Ratner giving a talk called From Guantanamo to WikiLeaks, Taking on the State in a Post-9/11 World. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. Police and thieves in the